To introduce our speaker tonight, we have Ravinder. Ravinder, please.
Thank you, Andrew. I'll keep this brief because we are running late. Thank you all for turning up tonight. We know it's been a bit of a problem getting you all in here, but we'll go with that. Most of you know of Amy's work. I came across her work for the first time with the East Timor Action Network, where in 1991 she witnessed the massacre of more than 270 civilians in Dili in East Timor. She's worked tirelessly for the East Timor Action Network and also for many other activist groups subsequent to that. Currently, she's working with Pacifica Radio. She does the daily Democracy Now! Radio show. And this is a particularly poignant time to have Amy come and speak because of the problems that she personally is experiencing at Pacifica. So please welcome, join me in welcoming Amy Goodman.
Thank you very much. It's great to be out here. Well, I want to thank the East Timor Action Network of Pasadena and also Caltech for hosting me tonight. And thank all of you for coming out and crowding in here. I really appreciate this. It is a very important weekend with two significant anniversaries. Today is November 10th, 2000, and 5 years ago on this day, Ken Sarawiwa was executed by the Nigerian military with the support of Shell Corporation. 2 days from now, November 12th, it's the 9th anniversary of the massacre of East Timor. And we've certainly come a long way since then. Timor is now on its way to freedom, but they have had to pay just an incredible price for that. And a large part of that price, I think, can be attributed to this country, to the United States. I thought I'd start off by reading an excerpt from Ken Sarawiwa's last speech before the military tribunal of Nigeria that tried him. Tried him for his crime of coming back to his people in Ogoni land. You know, Ken Sarawiwa was the leading playwright of Nigeria, known for writing the most popular soap opera in Nigeria, and was head of the Nigerian Writers Association. But with all of his success, he said he could not ignore the plight of his people, 500,000 Ogoni, who live in Ogoni land in the Niger Delta, who were fighting the battle of their lives, of their entire population, their culture, their land, against a large multinational corporation, Shell. He took that struggle, and perhaps this was his greatest crime, international, and he let people all over the world know what it meant to fill their tanks with Shell. And as he stood before the military tribunal, before they sentenced him and 8 other activists to death, he said, "My Lord, we all stand before history. I am a man of peace, of ideas, appalled by the denigrating poverty of my people who live on a richly endowed land, distressed by their political marginalization and economic strangulation, angered by the devastation of their land, their ultimate heritage, anxious to preserve their right to life and to a decent living, and determined to usher to this country as a whole a fair and just democratic system which protects everyone and every ethnic group and gives us all a valid claim to human civilization. I have devoted my intellectual and material resources, my very life, to a cause in which I have total belief and from which I cannot be blackmailed or intimidated. I have no doubt at all about the ultimate success of my cause. No matter the trials and tribulations which I and those who believe with me may encounter on our journey, nor imprisonment nor death can stop our ultimate victory. I repeat that we all stand before history. I and my colleagues are not the only ones on trial. Shell is here on trial." He goes on to speak about Nigeria, about his people, the Ogoni, about Shell. He says the military does not act alone. They're supported by a gaggle of politicians, lawyers, judges, academics, and businessmen. And he ends by saying, in my innocence of the false charges I face here, in my utter conviction, I call upon the Ogoni people, the peoples of the Niger Delta, and the oppressed ethnic minorities of Nigeria to stand up now and fight fearlessly and peacefully for their rights. History is on their side. God is on their side. This definitely brings back memories for me, because in 1994, just before Ken Saro-Wiwa went back to Nigeria and was imprisoned, he came to the United States. And we at WBAI, the Pacifica station in New York where I work, were one of the few people to interview him. I actually hadn't even heard about him at the time. And this man walked in and I said, I don't even know if we're going to be able to have time. We hadn't booked him for the show. And we said, okay, we'll give him a couple minutes. He's come from Nigeria after all. And then as he spoke, we bumped the rest of the show. I mean, I really did not know anything about him before he came into the studio. But this was a great man. You could sense it immediately as he talked about the plight of his people. It also shows how great Pacifica is, because the people who brought him to the United States knew that it was WBAI that would hear him out, that would provide a microphone. And he was almost interviewed by no one else in this country. A man who was taking on the power of the state, the power of the corporations, the power of the United States supporting the Nigerian dictatorship. Here he was, one man representing 500,000 people. And he said in that interview, I am a marked man if I go back. He went back, was arrested, tried, and on November 10, 1995, he was executed. 3 years later, I got a chance to go to Nigeria. Now, there was a moment when Abacha, the military dictator who had killed Ken Saro-Wiwa, died, and there was a moment, a small opening, when we thought we could get a visa. I went there with another reporter, Jeremy Scahill. Regular KPFK listeners know what an incredible job Jeremy's been doing from Yugoslavia, where he has moved. But Jeremy and I went to Nigeria in the summer of 1998. And the high point of this trip is we were investigating, well, your oil company in Nigeria, another one, the largest corporation headquartered in California, Chevron. We went to Ogoni land and we went to Ken's house and we met his parents, who were still grieving. And as we stood there, hundreds of people came to Ken's house to sing to us the Ogoni anthem. And one man stood up and he read Ken's last speech from heart, by heart. And we included that in our documentary, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. What we discovered was another company, Chevron, doing similar things as Shell, which had for a time been driven out of Ogoni land. We found what Chevron was doing in an area called Elijah land, where on May 28, 1998, when once again, and this happens all the time in the Niger Delta, villagers were protesting the environmental devastation that occurs because of these oil companies that drill the power from to provide power to the most powerful countries in the world and yet increasingly disempower these host communities where they get the oil from. They were drilling another oil spill. The people went to the barge and they said, we want to negotiate with the highest level representative. We want to negotiate with the American that represents Chevron here. They wanted to negotiate with George Kirkland, who is the head of Chevron Nigeria Limited, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Chevron based up in San Francisco. They refused Chevron, but they did send a person to negotiate with them. And after a few days, when the people on the barge who had occupied the barge were getting word from their elders who were doing the negotiations on land that they thought that the negotiations would be concluding, they started to pack up. And on that last morning, on May 28, 1998, they saw Chevron helicopters flying in, and they figured that they would be bringing in the Nigerian, that they would be bringing in the final negotiators. Instead of the final negotiators being brought in, Chevron Corporation brought in the Nigerian military and the mobile police known as the Kill and Go. That's the Kill and Go. And they opened fire on the protesters, and they executed two of them, critically wounded a third. They had a bunch of other protesters rounded up, brought off to the notorious Nigerian jails. And that was just another day in the Niger Delta. The corporate media in this country hardly cover those kinds of stories. When they do cover stories in the Niger Delta, it's usually about a gas pipeline that blows up. You read about it and they say things like AP says this, the New York Times says this, and it comes from the press releases of the corporations that own these pipelines. They say things like vandals and thieves once again drilled a hole in a pipeline and that's what caused it to burst. They never arrested one of these quote vandals or thieves. AP and the New York Times had a piece where it said, this was just last year, the proof that they were vandals and thieves was that they're carrying little containers. These are kids who come with broken cups and anything that they can carry to these leaky pipelines that the communities have begged the companies to fix for decades. And the kids will come and they'll try to collect it in any way they can because they don't get the oil or gas themselves. They have nothing in the Niger Delta. So they come and they try to take advantage of this. They say the vandals and thieves, mainly children, their charred bodies were found still cupping those containers, which showed that they were thieves. It's an incredible story, what goes on there, especially as we read about the oil crisis here. And we think about just the price of the oil that goes into our tanks, when that's really the price of the oil in Nigeria. And that's why it's so important to have an independent press. Jeremy and I found a quote of George Kirkland, the head of Nigeria, Chevron Nigeria Limited, in Nigeria's Oil and Gas, which is a magazine that comes out monthly. He said, "We're more likely to see other companies as collaborators rather than adversaries. We aren't so much competing with each other as we are competing with the earth." And maybe that's a healthy way to look at it, he says. We aren't so much competing with each other as we are competing with the earth. And that's maybe a healthy way to look at it. And that's precisely what these people were protesting. And it's also what people around the world now are rising up against. And that's where all the hope is right now. Democracy Now! Went out in force to Seattle, November of 1999. We didn't go out with the rest of the press after, you know, it appeared that it was going to be a very big story, but we took the whole team and more out because these were the voices that we had been broadcasting for years. We've almost been on now for 5 years. We began as the only daily election show in public broadcasting in February of 1996. And we realized that this event was going to be big, that this was a true global uprising against corporate power, and that it had to be covered by independent media. You know, probably most of you, the history of Pacifica, which is a very proud and long history that we almost fight to preserve. In 1949, Lew Hill, a pacifist who'd been in prison during World War II, came out of prison and said there had to be a media outlet that was not run by corporations that were building a drumbeat to a third world war, because war is profitable for corporations, but there had to be a media outlet that was run by journalists and artists. Journalists and artists who didn't have that same agenda, the same agenda of corporations, who is George Gerbner, the founder of the Cultural Environ Movement, says, "Corporations with nothing to tell and everything to sell. The corporations that are raising our children, They're spending more time watching television and being raised by these companies than they are in the company of their parents and their families and their communities. And that's how Pacifico was born, a remarkable experiment in 1949. And then the other stations came on board, KPFK here, 90.7 FM in Texas, KPFT, which was, its transmitter was blown up twice in the first year of operation in 1970 by the Ku Klux Klan. And when the exalted Cyclops went on trial for those acts, he said it was his proudest moment, his proudest act, because he knew what Pacifico was about. It was about opening microphones to the most disempowered, marginalized people to fight bigotry. Because once you hear people speaking, it's much harder to hate. It's just inevitable that you will find yourself identifying. And that's the idea of Pacifica, is to increase understanding and communication. WPFW went on the air in Washington in 1977, and WBAI, the place where I work in New York, went on air January of 1960, and is now 40 years old. That was owned by a man named Lou Schweitzer, a philanthropist, broadcasting from the roof of the Hotel Pierre. I can't think of a more strange contrast to what we are today. But when the newspapers were struck, the Herald Tribune and others, all the advertisers raced to radio, and he realized how advertisement-driven the media was. And he, too, understood there had to be something that was independent. And so he called the Pacifica Foundation in Berkeley, and he said, I give you this station. And that's how we went on the air. And so we have something very important to preserve as we move into the next millennium. The only independent media network in this country. It is so important. I realized the importance of it just a few days ago when President Clinton called. It was on election day. It was about 10 minutes to 9 when all mortals know they do not call they don't call into the Democracy Now! Office if they want to live beyond the show. And so when the phone rang, I thought, well, this must be important. So I picked up the phone, and someone said, this is White Horse Communications. And there is a bar in New York called the White Horse. And I said, what? And they said, it's White Horse Communications. The president would like to come on the radio. And I said, the president of what? I would have said, the president of the United States. I said, right. I figured this was a new one to get the internal line to master control. But she was persistent and said he was making calls to talk about getting the vote out. And I said, okay, I just had to get off the phone. So I gave the internal line to master control. And we went on with the show. And as our completely crazed producers were trying to get us on line, I said to Maria, who has come back from Spain to produce for a month now, Maria Carrion, an absolutely wonderful woman, producer, reporter, who has been very involved, particularly in death penalty cases. We had her father on the air this morning, Ignacio Carrion, if you were listening. He was one of those who were there to the end of Miguel Flores' life, which ended yesterday at 6:20 Texas time. He was number 147 for George W. Bush, the governor of Texas, who could well be the leader of, well, not only this country, but as Sebastião Salgado, the great Brazilian photojournalist, said, you are electing the president of the planet. And so there was George Bush yesterday as this country was determining his fate, hardly actually carefully weighing the fate of this man, and he died at 6:20. But Maria, as she was getting everything ready for us to go on, I said, oh, Maria, just one last thing. If the president calls, if you have any questions or anything, just let me know what you would want to ask him. And she turned to me. And she said, just turn on the mic and get on the air. You know what I was talking about? We did the show, he didn't call, and it confirmed my suspicions that it probably was White Horse Communications. And then when we got off the air at about 11 o'clock, we got a call in Master Control. It was the Latino music show, La Nueva Alternativa. And I went in, and they said, this is the White House, the president's on the line. Gonzalo Alberto, who is the host of that program, we hooked him in. They said it would be a minute because he was getting a call from the vice president. And then I sat down, and then all of a sudden we heard under the music, it was some Latino rap music, we heard President Clinton sang an inimitable Pacifica opening to conversations. Hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me? And Gonzalo was having trouble. He was a little befuddled, and he was forgetting to bring down the CD. So there you hear in the background, can you hear me? At which point I leaped over the master control board, bruising my hip, throwing down the music, putting on all the microphones, and got ready to do the interview that we had not planned for, less than 5 seconds worth. They said again that he wanted to talk about voter turnout. So I said, Mr. President, are you there? Which is actually a deep question, but anyway. He said, I am. Can you hear me? And I said, yes, we can. You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations? And that they are, that they feel at this point that their vote doesn't make a difference. Now, I had just caught my breath because I had climbed back over the master. And he said, well, there's just not a shred of evidence to support that. And he talked for a while, and I figured he was going to get off the phone very quickly, and I wanted to address a few issues. And so I said, President Clinton, since it's rare to get to talk to you on the phone, let me ask you another question, and that is, what's your position on granting Leonard Peltier the Native American Activist? He said, well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I think that I believe there's a new application for him in there. When I have time after the election is over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications. He said, I'll try to do what I think the right thing is based on the evidence. I've never actually had time to sit down myself and review the case, but I know it's very important to a lot of people. He added, maybe on both sides of the issue, and I think I owe it to them to give it an honest look, see. So part of my responsibilities in the last 10 weeks of office after the election will be to review the request for pardons and executive clemencies and give them a fair hearing, and I pledge to do that, which was very significant. He has never publicly addressed the Leonard Peltier case, though it's the longest standing executive clemency case on his desk. I said, will you give an answer in his case? And he said, yes, I'll decide one way or the other. And yet he was not saying, you know, I'm going to hang up the phone. So I said, well, and finally, do you support a moratorium on the death penalty, given the studies that show how racist it is? And he went on to say that he understands, you know, that there are some studies, but he sort of hedged the question. And then went on to ask him questions about why, I said, I guess many people were quite disturbed that when you first ran for president, you went back in the midst of your campaign to Arkansas and presided over the execution of a mentally impaired man. And he said, well, he wasn't mentally impaired when he committed the murder, and so he said that he did go back and he felt it was the right thing to do. Gonzalo then asked him why Latinos and Latinas should vote for Gore and Lieberman. And I followed up with the why he insists on the U.S. Navy continuing to bomb Vieques. And he said interesting things there, raising issues that he understands the people of Vieques don't want their island bombed. He said that we have to do it until we can find somewhere else. I didn't get into the issues of they not only, the United States not only bombs Vieques, but they lease it out to NATO allies to bomb so they can have practice of targets. Gonzalo asked about undocumented workers, and I asked about the sanctions against Iraq that are killing 5,000 children a month. He said that's just not true. It's a lie. They're not killing 5,000 children a month. Saddam Hussein is. And I said, then why have the past two UN heads of the program in Iraq quit calling the U.S. policy, the U.S. UN policy, genocidal? He said they're wrong. And then he was staying on the phone, and he talked extensively about the issue. Asked him about the policy in Cuba, why we're normalizing relations with China but continue the embargo, and asked him about the Middle East. The whole issue of Amnesty International saying that what the Israeli forces are engaged is war crimes, and asked him why people shouldn't vote for Ralph Nader, considering he has brought the party so far to the right. It was then that he got a little annoyed. He said, now you just listen to me, you ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone. But I really let him answer every question, and he wasn't hanging up, and so I said, when he said that, you're hostile, combative, and even disrespectful, I said, well, then I just have two more questions. And I asked him about why he hasn't issued an executive order banning racial profiling. I mean, you have Al Gore, who has said it would be one of his first acts, yet he's been in power for like 8 years. Why haven't they done it to this point? Now, these questions are not that big a deal. It's what's on a lot of people's minds in this country, talking about corporate control, talking about racism and public policy, talking about foreign policy. But we don't have an independent media base in this country where you're going to get these questions asked on any regular basis. And you see the kind of pressures we're under, because the next day I got a call from Newsday. They wanted to follow up on the interview, and as I was talking to them, the White House called on the other line. This time I knew it wasn't that bar, that it was the White House. And I put the phone down with Newsday, and I went to the other line, and it ended up he heard this whole conversation, the Newsday reporter, as it got extremely heated. And it was the head of White House Communications, and she said that they would withhold all further cooperation with WBAI and our network, given that I had broken the ground rules. And I said, and what exactly were the ground rules? Should I told you he had 2 or 3 minutes? And so she said, we had agreed on that. I said, first of all, you gave me about a second. You said, the president is on the phone, he has a couple minutes, and of course I would push it, and he could have hung up at any point. And she said, no, he could not have. I said, the man is the leader of the he could have hung up the phone if he wanted to. And she said, not only did you spend his time, he had other important things to do. And I was just thinking of maybe actually in that 30-minute period, which I think was the longest phone interview he'd ever conducted, we saved some lives. Maybe by distracting him, we didn't bomb Afghanistan again, or the Sudan, Iraq, which we are doing on a regular basis every week. Maybe for that just 30-minute time, there was some peace in the world. I don't know. But he said, she said that there were two things I had violated. One was I'd gone beyond the 2 to 3 minutes. And the other, and then I said, but he didn't even ask to get off until around 24 minutes in. He said, this will be the last question. And then I just asked one other question. She said, you asked two other questions. But the other thing that particularly aggravated them, which was why they were blacklisting me from the White House, was that she had made it very clear to me, as she had to the other reporters, but those reporters had followed the rules. He had talked to about 40 radio stations on Tuesday, that he wanted to talk about voter turnout. She said, now your first question related to that. And then she said, and something like the fifth question, the seventh question had some resonance with that issue. But the rest of the questions were far afield, and that's not what we had agreed upon. And I said, I may come as a surprise, but I am a reporter, and you did not fax over the questions, but of course we wouldn't have followed them, and it is not my problem if the rest of the media agreed to those ground rules, but obviously... the Newsday called the White House spokesperson, who said, any good reporter understands that if you violate the ground rules in an interview, that's going to be taken into account the next time you're seeking an interview. But I think perhaps the last laugh is on them, because I will not be allowed to go to the White House for the next 3 weeks or so. Something like that. But in the end, it's probably not me that's getting thrown out, but it's them. I don't even necessarily think that's the case. I do think that the election is still up for grabs. I mean, I'm waiting any moment now for Ralph Nader to be announced. But what's going on right now is very important, and I think it is a time for people to take to the streets, because there's certain times in history or in a year that where there is this moment where everyone is focused on the same thing, a national conversation is going on, and people all see a problem with the system. Right now, everyone is focused on Florida. But what's happened in Florida is very important. And if you were listening to Democracy Now! This morning, we were speaking to the head of the Democratic Club of Broward County, also the vice chair of the Democrats in the county that includes Orlando. And we're hearing story after story of disenfranchised people, usually, of course, people of color. In Broward County, we're talking about something like 6,600 ballots that everyone else was voted for, but the president, it looks like the punch holes were not punched through enough. But in Orlando, the Puerto Ricans who voted, there's a large Puerto Rican community there, perhaps the largest in the United States, were being challenged. Do you have two forms of identification which you don't need? But this is something that has gone on in America for a very long time. African Americans in Florida being told that it was too crowded and busy, they should come back another time. I mean, African Americans in the South know what it means to be barred from the polls, and no one has cared for a very long time. And now that it's in the interest of the major corporate parties, we are going to see some light shed on this, and we hope that the whole thing is blown right open and we can really see the bars to those who try to vote, but also expand it to why people don't vote in this country. I still haven't gotten the number of people who have voted in the country on Election Day. It almost never goes above half. Again, President Clinton, last elected, was something like 27% of the vote. And you think about the people who die all over the world to go out and vote and to be able to determine the future of their country. Why don't people hear? I don't think it's because people are apathetic. I think they feel that there's no choice, that they don't, that their voice will not be heard. But I think things are changing. I think the protests, the uprisings in Seattle and the Democratic and Republican conventions in Prague and Windsor and Calgary, these things are just getting bigger and bigger. These are major eruptions. And then you have the third party candidates like Ralph Nader. No, he didn't hit the 5% bar to get federal matching funds, but he has had a tremendous effect. I mean, just ask Al Gore. And the idea that press outlets like the New York Times continue their relentless attack on him. Here is someone who, at his super rallies, have had the largest number of people coming out who are paying to hear what he has to say. Somewhere around 15 to 20,000 at Madison Square Garden in New York, 8 to 10,000 in Oakland, I was at that super rally. Washington, D.C., more than 12,000 people. There is something that is happening. That the press is not covering, that they are forced to cover only in a negative way how it impacts the other candidates. And the idea that they're saying that he is I think the New York Times editorial page said a narcissistic egotist. then what does that make Gore and Brooke? But what's happening today in Florida hopefully will open up a lot of issues. Like Human Rights Watch and the Sentencing Project have put out this report that shows that the permanent disenfranchisement of over 400,000 ex-offenders in Florida is likely to have determined the outcome of the presidential election. Almost one-third of the African-American men in Florida were unable to vote because of a felony conviction at some point in their past. Florida is only one of 13 states that deny the vote to ex-offenders who have fully served their sentences. It's an incredible fact. 31.2% of black men in Florida, again, almost a third, were excluded from the polls. Almost every state in the United States denies prisoners the right to vote. 14 states bar criminal offenders from voting even after they have finished their sentences. In these states, over 1 million ex-offenders are permanently disenfranchised. These are things that must be discussions that we must have right now. And again, it's not only in Florida. Maybe we have to go from state to state and analyze exactly what is happening with the state of American democracy today. And I don't think it has to take a day or a week. It can take all the time we need to restore or bring democracy to this country, perhaps for the first time. And this really is a moment that people should be thinking very creatively about alternatives. I mean, for example, the Center for Proportional Representation. I mean, if that alone, why aren't they being interviewed on a regular basis? You have Gore winning the popular vote, something like he has 200,000 more votes than Bush, and yet we're talking about Bush winning the presidential election because he has a couple hundred more votes, perhaps, in Florida, the ones that are being tabulated right now. The idea you could have something like, if we had a different kind of system, a European parliamentary system, you could have the Democrats and the Greens forming a coalition government. You could have it that in each state, if you get 51 votes and the loser gets 49 votes, why does that loser not get any form of representation at all? That's what proportional representation is about. And these are the discussions that we have to have. These are the discussions that we try to bring up on a daily basis, these kinds of discussions on Democracy Now! And why an independent media is so important and yet is so under siege in this country. So few outlets, even though there are more and more channels, there are fewer and fewer companies that are owning them. Now, the topic of tonight's talk is Democracy Now! From East Timor to the United States. And I don't think I can ever give a talk without talking about East Timor because of everything that it represents in terms of U.S. foreign policy, in terms of just the issue of people's tremendous optimism, perseverance, you know, desire for democracy in the face of terrible devastation, unfortunately, ultimately at the hands of the United States. I'm sure most all of you know the story, if you're regular listeners to Pacifica. But being that Sunday is the 9th anniversary of the massacre, an event that I can still feel and taste and will never forget any minute of my life, Timor, a small country that was occupied by Indonesia in 1975 on December 7th, the day before President Clinton and President Ford and Henry Kissinger met with Suharto, the longest reigning dictator in the world, gave the go-ahead for the invasion. 90% of the weapons were from the United States, and they invaded East Timor by land, by air, and by sea, killing thousands of people in the first days. The U.S. monitoring every single step of what was happening from spy satellites in Australia, knowing how brutal and bloody it was. Even high-level members of the State Department were objecting, and as President Ford and Kissinger made their way from Jakarta to visit another great leader of Asia, Ferdinand Marcos, they were getting reports about how this invasion was going. And when Kissinger got back to the United States, he held a high-level State Department meeting, furious that two memos on paper had been sent to him talking about the brutality and saying, we will not leave a paper trail, we will not kick our allies in the teeth. And that began a quarter of a century occupation of East Timor that could not have been carried out without the full support of the United States, a third of the population killed, 200,000 people. But even with that, as the Indonesian military closed the country to the outside world and carried out the genocide, the people always had hope and always had faith that the people in the United States would make the difference, would stop this from happening. I got a chance to go to East Timor in 1990 with another reporter, Alan Nairn, and we went back in 1991. And on November 12th, 1991, well, we had gotten there 2 weeks before. We went to the church, which really had become the center of opposition throughout East Timor, the Catholic Church. Timor had been a Portuguese colony, and then Portugal had abandoned East Timor, and that's when the Indonesian military had moved in. But in almost just a kind of act of resistance, though the people, only a third of the population was converted to Catholicism under the Portuguese. Once the Indonesian military moved in, almost the entire country converted to Catholicism just because it was a place where people, the churches were places where people could gather. And the priests were, and nuns, just incredibly brave and tried to protect their congregations. And it was one of the only places that people could assemble and gather and speak, and that young people could see some kind of role model and hope for the future. We went to the church the first day we went back in 1991 in Dili, the capital of East Timor, and after the mass where women were crying, we learned that the night before the Indonesian military had surrounded the church, the Motael church in Dili, and shot into it and killed a young man who was taking refuge there. We had gone there in 1991 because for the first time the UN had brokered an agreement between Indonesia and Portugal to allow a Portuguese parliamentary delegation to come and investigate the human rights situation for the first time. In the end, we learned when this delegation was canceled that it was at the behest of the United States that it was canceled, because for the first time people outside of Timor would really get word about what was happening inside. So in the two-week period before November 12th, we went around the country to see how the Timorese were preparing for the delegation to come. We learned that they were dropping out of school and work and gathering in churches, taking refuge because they were afraid they would be arrested before the Indonesian, before the delegation came, and they wanted to be able to tell their stories. But by November 12th, 1991, we understood that the delegation wouldn't come, and the people were extremely frustrated. And so on this day, 2 weeks after the first funeral for Sebastião Gomes, the young man who was killed, the people went to early morning mass, more than 1,000 people, and in an act of unprecedented defiance against the Indonesian military that was supported by the number one superpower in the world, the United States, as they left the mass, they unfurled banners that said things like, why the Indonesian military shoot our church, and they appealed to President Bush and to Australia and to Portugal to do something to end the reign of terror against them. And they marched in this way to the cemetery. Thousands of people, and they joined from their workplaces and their homes and their communities, and they filled the streets of Dili that were dotted with torture houses, whether they were police stations or military compounds or sergeants or colonel or generals' homes where Timorese were kept. Even in the hotels, Timorese would be tortured in the back. It was a true architecture of pain, a geography that the Timorese knew very well, knew every torture house in East Timor. And they marched through the streets and they went to the cemetery. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and Alan and I were following them. We got to the cemetery, we were interviewing people, why do you risk your lives? and they would say the same thing over and over for freedom, for independence. And little kids were putting their hands up in a V sign. There were old women in their traditional Timorese garb, girls in their Catholic school uniforms with their skirts, and boys with their Catholic school shorts. And at that point, as we stood right in front of the cemetery, someone looked up and saw the Indonesian military marching up from the same direction the procession had come, about 10 to 12 abreast, and they marched up in their military uniforms holding their USM-16s, hundreds of them marching up. Alan and I went to the front of the crowd because we thought, though they had committed many massacres in the past, they wouldn't do it in front of Western journalists, and we took our equipment out, which we always hid so we wouldn't endanger the people who spoke with us, and I held up my microphone like a flag and put on my headphones, and Alan put the camera above his head. We walked to the front of the crowd. There was a young man from Australia named Kamal Bamanhaj who was there with a camera. We asked him if he wanted to come forward. He felt it was more strategic to step back, and he moved back. We went to the front. Soldiers marched up, and without any warning or provocation, without any hesitation, as they rounded the corner, they opened fire on everyone, gunning people down from left to right. As for us, they had enveloped us and shot everyone behind us, and they threw me to the ground, shaking my microphone in my face as if to say, this is what we don't want. And they were kicking me and hitting me with rifle butts, and Alan threw himself on top of me to protect me, and they took their USM-16s, the butts of the rifles, and they slammed them against his head until they fractured his skull. So we were lying in the road. He couldn't protect himself any longer because his whole body was in spasm from the continuous beatings. And they had stripped us of everything, and they kept saying, where are you from? They kept saying, Australia, Australia. And we knew what had happened to the Australian journalists in 1975 when Indonesia first invaded East Timor. There were five journalists covering the events leading up to the invasion. And the Indonesian military had come upon them in a small town called Balibo, and they had lined them up against a house and executed them, actually cut off their genitals, put them in their mouths, and then they suffocated and they shot them. The man who was in charge of that operation, Yunus Yosfia, was recently, in the last few years, made head of information of Indonesia, and the New York Times would refer to him as the moderate. He was put in charge of the press in Indonesia. So we knew what had happened to the journalists in the past. The last reporter, when Indonesia invaded, was in a radio station in Dili, the capital of East Timor. His name was Roger East, and they dragged him out of the radio station as he shouted, I'm from Australia, I'm from Australia. They shot him into the harbor with all of the other Timorese that they were dragging down to the harbor. So as they shouted to us, Australia, Australia, and they put the guns to our heads, about 12 of them in firing squad fashion, I kept saying, as they would kick me in the stomach and get my breath back, no, America, America. And at some point, they decided to take the guns from our heads because I think we were from the same country that their weapons were from, and they would have to pay a price for killing us that they never had to pay for killing the Timorese. So we were lying in the road. They moved on to kill the people who were wounded but not yet dead around us. The whole area had become a killing field, the cemetery. The Red Cross drove up. They picked up an old man who had been dragged into a sewer ditch next to us as he put up his hands in the prayer sign. They would beat him down. And the Red Cross picked him up. We got in the Jeep and we raced to the hospital. But then Timorese stopped the vehicle and dozens of people jumped on top of us and on top of the car. And we drove like that as a human mass to the hospital because it was a residential area. And everyone was trying to get away. When we got to the hospital, there were the Timorese who were lucky, who were not yet dead, who were being operated on by the doctors and the nurses. And when they saw us, though, the doctors and nurses, they started to cry. I think because the Timorese were in much worse shape, they really felt like they had lost all hope, that they saw the Americans as a shield for them, strangely enough, and that when that shield was bloodied, that they had no other protection. There were two little girls when I was walking alongside the procession who wrapped their arms around mine and they wouldn't let go. And I thought it put them in danger, and it made me a part of the protest, which could make the whole thing even more dangerous. And I tried to disentangle myself from them, but it was the same thing. They saw us as their only protection, you know, hang on to the Americans, because probably what would happen to them would not happen to us. They see us as that shield. And it's not just Timorese, it's people all over the world who turn to us. And then I think about us on election day, how few people go out to vote to determine how we affect the rest of the world, because people feel that it really doesn't matter who you choose, they all pretty much represent the same thing, but that we really can make a difference. We can find people, we can be those people who run for office that will not provide the kind of support that the US government has provided for years to the Indonesian regime or the Nigerian military or the Guatemalan government. This is our choice to make, and I think as we are now in this year 2000 and we see the crisis that's what the corporate media is calling a major crisis, we really can turn things around. That day, the Indonesian military, 9 years ago Sunday, killed more than 250 Timorese, 271 on that day on the road in Dili, outside of the Santa Cruz Cemetery. We were able to escape. We went into hiding, actually, in a couple of places. One of them was at the Bishop's house, Bishop Fellow, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize. And we decided there's just no way to stop the killing as we're here in Timor. If there's some way we could get out, we could get word to the outside world, and it would have to come from international pressure. So we got out, tried to get to the airport, tanks rolling in the streets, they closed down the whole city. And when we got to the airport, we said we had to leave. Alan was still covered in blood. We changed his shirt. He was wearing the bishop's shirt, cleaned him up enough so that it wouldn't be as apparent that we had been at the massacre site, or maybe the military at the airport, because the whole place was military run. Decided that since they had decided not to kill us, now they just wanted us out of the country, not to witness it. And we were able to, after arguing back and forth, get onto that plane, get out of the country, fly on to Bali, and make contact with the Western world, say there was a massacre, and then make it to the United States. That was 1991. You'd sort of think at that point there would be a massive change, considering that it was irrefutable what the Indonesian military had done, and they'd done it with our weapons. But it was the growth of the East Timor Action Network from that point on that slowly but surely educated the people of this country, lobbied Congress, that started a process of making people aware in this country, along with Noam Chomsky's writings. Noam Chomsky's talked about this since 1975. Making people aware of what US policy was doing, how it was supporting the military of the fourth largest country in the world, Indonesia, which not only oppressed the people of East Timor, but their own population. Why were they doing that? Why were they supporting the military? Well, just look at your feet. Nike, Reebok, Adidas, all these companies that went to Indonesia for cheap labor. If there was a strong military, the girls and the women who came from the countryside would know that they couldn't organize, that if they asked for more than $2 a day, that the same military that was wiping out the people of Timor was outside the gates of the Nike plants and the Reebok plants. But slowly but surely, and this is where the hope is in this country, more and more people came to understand what was happening because of this incredibly powerful grassroots group, the East Timor Action Network, and more people coming through and talking about their experiences. They had military weapons sales cut off to Indonesia through the years as President Clinton pushed very hard to continue them right through this day, and it raised awareness. And then the ultimate moment came. Alan and I in 1994 went back. We got arrested as we tried to get into Timor. We were banned from ever returning to Indonesia or East Timor because we had witnessed the massacre. Now I have to add the White House to the list. I can't return to the White House because I question it was a plan. But in 1997, Alan got in underground into Indonesia, and he revealed in Jakarta, the capital, that the U.S. that Clinton had managed the Pentagon, even though Congress had cut off military training aid, to continue to train the Indonesian military. But then 1999 happened, and it was this remarkable moment after the people overthrew Suharto, the longest reigning dictator in the world. The United Nations went ahead and pushed for a referendum in East Timor where the people would get to decide their own future. And it really was truly remarkable. And it was all to the credit of the Timorese. No matter how many Timorese died, young Timorese replaced them, remembered them, held up the hopes of those who had fallen before them, and always believed that they would be free. I was continually astounded over those years to hear the hope in the voices of young Timorese. And many of them had not even been born when the invasion had taken place. So they'd only known occupation, but they always knew they would be free. So the summer of 1999, a year ago, and the people prepared to vote. Because of Indonesian military violence, the vote was put off a few times, but finally it happened on August 30th, 1999. As the people went out to vote, almost all of them, you know, women carried in stretchers who were in their, about to die would go to the polls. They wanted to vote first. Women who had just given birth to babies would walk miles, days to get to a voting place. Everyone went to those polls to vote for their freedom. And at the same time, the Indonesian military had developed a strategy, which was to support militias, give them some deniability, the Indonesian military itself, and they razed the country to the ground over this period of 2 weeks last summer. And even through all of this, the Timorese went to the polls. Alan had gotten into the country again, along with many other East Timor Action Network people from around this country, to be poll watchers, to go through this process with the Timorese. And you just saw the power of solidarity and what it meant. Though I was deported, I wasn't able to get in, but the stories I heard from people in this room who went, the just incredible gratitude that the Timorese felt toward others who were risking their lives, who were in Timor, to make sure that this was a free and fair vote. It truly was truly momentous, and the people voted overwhelmingly for their freedom, and the Indonesian military destroyed the country in the process as a kind of goodbye, sadistic goodbye operation. President Clinton was right nearby in New Zealand at an APEC summit, continued to support the military almost to the end, but then all of the international media was there for this historic moment, and it could no longer be denied what the Indonesian military was doing. And finally, after all of these years, President Clinton was just in a long line of presidents who had supported the Indonesian military, starting with Ford through Carter, Reagan, Bush, and then Clinton. Finally, he did what activists in the East Timorese had begged for years for him to do. He threatened the Indonesian military for a moment. He said, if you don't stop, we will withdraw aid, support for you. We will cut off our military relationship with you. And as he made that threat, Britain followed suit and said they would do the same thing. They would cut off the military relationship, and Indonesia agreed to withdraw. Imagine if this had been done in 1975. Well, if Kissinger and Ford hadn't given the go-ahead. Imagine in 1980 at the height of the killings. Imagine. And so 200,000 lives later, an entire country destroyed. And because of the international media spotlight, President Clinton finally made a move. Despite all the Indonesian mogul support for his presidencies, you know, his biggest contributor was James Riady, who with his father Mokhtar Riady ran the Lippo Bank in Indonesia, who he would welcome into the White House time after time, but never invited José Ramos Horta, a Bishop Fellow, the Nobel Peace Prize winners of Timor. Finally, they threatened Indonesia, and within a day, Indonesia caved and said they would pull out. So you see what difference it makes, what difference the United States makes. After the vote, still the people of Timor, despite all that had happened and how many people died, were overjoyed at what they had accomplished. Bittersweet, but very, very important. And now in this last year, they are fighting, they are rebuilding their country, and they need all the support that they can get. At a time when the little media attention that they've gotten over the years diminishes even more, this is a time for people like you to give as much support as possible. It's one of the rare times in history that a new country is born, that a country begins from ground zero and rebuilds itself, creates a constitution, and develops civil society, and not in fear. You can now go into East Timor without going through Indonesia. José Ramos Horta has just been named the foreign minister on behalf of by the UN Transitional Authority, and sometime next year they will have elections and they will declare themselves a fully independent country. At the same time, though, in Indonesia, the people of Indonesia are waging a mighty battle against the Indonesian military so that it removes itself from civil society and from governance. Right now, the big area of struggle is Aceh, one of the biggest oil and gas fields of Mobil is there. Business Week did a piece about a year ago that got very little attention that showed a man holding out a skull, and it said, "What Mobil knew?" And it's about how the allegations that Mobil provided excavating equipment to the Indonesian military to dig mass graves to put in the Indonesian workers to put the Indonesian workers in who they had killed. The Indonesian military over this last 10 years has killed thousands of Muslims who live in Aceh. Aceh is on the western tip of Indonesia. They are demanding independence and a referendum as well because of the brutality against the Acehese. And what happened several months ago is that Acehese human rights activist, a lawyer who's been living in Queens, New York, named Jafar Sidik Hamza, went back to work with his people, in the same way we see has happened for the Timorese for so many years. He went back, was in constant touch with his family every 2 hours because of the danger he faced, and then just about 2 months ago, one of those times he was supposed to call his family, he didn't make the call, and his family knew he was taken. Probably by the Indonesian military. They searched and they waited word, and then five bodies turned up wrapped in barbed wire in a field, and it turns out one of them was Jafar Sidik Hamza's. And again, this is all too common in Aceh. As East Timor tries to rebuild itself, it still has its history to remember and what happened to it. And as with so many other places, the East Timorese are calling for an international war crimes tribunal so that people like Suharto, that presided over much of that quarter of a century, are put on trial. We're not talking about the trials that he was, you know, going to be put through to do with corruption. We're talking about for the brutality that he presided over. But it can't just end with Suharto, because he never would have carried it out without the support of the United States, and that is absolutely critical to understand, is what the United States facilitates, what the United States allows to happen. The year after the massacre in which 271 Timorese were killed, Reebok Human Rights Awards event was taking place. And you may know those stories of the Reebok Human Rights Awards, but interestingly enough, on this day, a year later, they were honoring a Timorese named Fernando Duraujo, who had protested the massacre. Now, it was pretty ironic, obviously, Reebok giving him one of the Human Rights Awards. He was in an Indonesian jail. Reebok was making many of its sneakers in Indonesia. They were giving him something like supposedly $20,000 as an award, which they had withheld from Indonesian workers for all of those years, people getting paid something like $2 a day. But because Fernando was in jail, the Reebok Human Rights Foundation asked Alan and I if we would come up to Boston and describe the massacre to the crowd of thousands who were going to be honoring four human rights winners. We went back and forth on the issue, should we give it that kind of credibility? We understood that Reebok was just laundering. Its name was instead should simply pay the workers and stop supporting and working with the Indonesian military. But in the end, we decided it was an amazing moment because they would put all of their resources into broadcasting this event around the world. And so we could say something about what they were doing. And we went up to Boston, and before we went, I got a couple calls. The first was asking for my measurements. And I asked, well, why would you want to know them? And they said, well, because we have to give you the Reebok outfit and the Reebok sneakers. And then they invited us to stay at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston. And we said, no, thanks. You know, I have a brother who lives there. And it went on like that. And they got a little nervous, weren't quite used to journalists not accepting perks. And then we went up for this big event, which goes on to this day. All sorts of human rights groups were there, are being honored, also supported by probably the Reebok Human Rights Foundation. And in one sense, it's good that they should care about human rights, but they should do it through their business on a regular basis. So on that day in December 1992, we went up, and I saw the magnitude of this event and all the people that were lending their good name to it, Sybil Shepherd and Joan Baez and Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead and Peter Gabriel and Yo-Yo Ma, Richie Havens. This is who they gather every year to shore up their name. In fact, we sat down the first lunch before the big event, and I was trying to sit next to Richie Havens, and a guy sat down between us. And I said, oh, what's your name? And he said, my name is Michael Stipe. And I said, oh, are you one of Richie Havens' assistants? He said, no, I have my own little group. And I said, what's the name of it? You can see how out of it I am. And he said, it's called REM. So this was who came to these events. And the next day, they had the event. We had all gone there for rehearsal the day before to the Heinz Auditorium, and they asked us each to give our speeches. And I said, no, that's okay. I feel comfortable in front of a microphone. And they said, give the speech. I said, I haven't written it yet. And the next day, the event happened. Terry Anderson had just been freed from Lebanon. Remember, he was a hostage there. And he was going to come out and open the ceremony. So we all filed in. It was dark. There were thousands of people in this auditorium. They had about 20 video logos that were going of the Reebok symbol, which was a robot running, and then breaking through barbed wire. And as that robot ran and broke through barbed wire, Richie Havens started to sing, sometimes I feel like a mother's child, and started singing, freedom, freedom. And as he sang freedom, Terry Anderson got up and he said, freedom, today I am free. And Paul Fireman, the CEO of Reebok, got up and said, today we celebrate freedom. And that's how the whole event began. And then each person got up and gave the award, Sybil Shepherd to the woman who fought domestic violence, Mickey Hart to the man from Northern Ireland, Michael Stipe to the man from Zaire, now the Congo, and then Tabitha Soren, formerly of MTV and ABC, she was going to introduce us. She got up, she talked about Timor. The video showed pictures of Fernando, who was in jail. They showed pictures of the massacre. And she said, Amy and Alan survived the massacre, and they'll describe it to you now. And we each had 2 minutes. And so I got up and I described, you know, how do you make people even care? Remember, this is 1992, almost no one knows about Timor, and why would they even want to do something about it in less than 2 minutes? You convey to them the enormity of the crime. I described the massacre, told them what they were seeing on the video, and then Alan got up and he had 2 minutes, and he said, now you may wonder how something like this, how this genocide can take place in the late 20th century. Well, it's because of Reebok and Nike. was Reebok executives from around the world. Just went down like dominoes as they went to each other. And then he went on to say, you know, right now it's noon here, which means it's midnight in Timor. Just a very terrible time of pain when someone's being dragged out of their home, their fingernails or toenails being pulled out because they dare to fight for their own freedom. And in Indonesia, girls and women are brought in from the countryside to work in these Reebok plants, being paid less than $2 a day when someone like Paul Fireman, I think that year, U.S. News and U.S. Business and News, what is it, U.S. News and World Report, reported he was the second highest paid corporate executive in the world. And so he ended by saying, yes, it's taking place, and blood is on the hands of Reebok today. So he didn't get that kind of response, but anyway, then we were instructed in advance the day before. We were told that then Joan Baez would come out and sing Amazing Grace, and we would all put our arms around each other. The problem was Richie Havens had stepped away, and I was then standing next to Paul Fireman. So we stepped back, and they sang Amazing Grace, and we went through the auditorium, and then we were told to go into a room where every inch or so was the Reebok logo, so that any place that Joan Baez or Cybill Shepherd or Mickey Hart was, they would be photographed with that Reebok logo behind them. And as we walked into the room, the people said, not so fast. And we said, oh, we were told we have to come in here. And then there were questions asked, and they asked Paul Fireman about what was happening to the Reebok workers in Indonesia. Is this true? Where's the code of conduct? And they asked us questions, and a lot of reporters came up. The guy from Rolling Stone said, this is very important. And, you know, Alan Nairn is an absolutely remarkable journalist. And when the Indonesian military and militias in the summer of 1999, when the referendum took place, ravaged the country, Alan was the last foreign reporter there, and he was arrested. And from his jail cell in East Timor and then moved to West Timor, where they said that they were going to try him and would probably sentenced him to 10 years in jail. He was able to talk to us in Democracy Now! Every day, give reports about what was happening. And internally, being held in the military barracks in Timor, he saw the militias, that the barracks, the military barracks, were their staging ground. Another reason why independent media is so important. But he was able to keep his cell phone, and which gave new meaning to the term cell phone. One of those days, he debated Madeleine Albright on the Lehrer NewsHour. And he showed a picture of Alan. It was actually one we had gotten at the day of the massacre. The only evidence we had, since they had taken everything from us, was a person who photographed us 18 times. There was a picture of Alan, and there was Madeleine Albright. And you could only think, if we lived in a just world, in that debate, who should have been behind bars? But in the midst of all this, as Jose was in the United States in the heart of power, trying to get the U.S. to stop supporting the Indonesian military, he met with Madeleine Albright and a bunch of other high-level State Department people, and said at the end of the conversation, one last point, Madam Secretary, is we're asking you to free a hero of the Timorese people, as if, you know, it wasn't even the Indonesian military who was holding him, but the United States. And he said, you know, I don't, he said, when I stand with him giving a talk, he is the first to criticize the United States for what it has done, but he has really risked his life for the people of Timor. Madeleine Albright looked around the room at her high-level staff and said to them, what are you doing? As if she didn't know. And Stanley Roth, who is one of the people who's been deeply involved with this, Undersecretary of Pentagon, I believe, now goes back and forth between the State and Pentagon, said, Madam Secretary, I can't tell you the number of times Alan Nairn has called me a war criminal. He led the opposition to my nomination. but we are doing all we can to have him freed. Ultimately, because I think it was more grassroots pressure of thousands of people from around the country calling into the State Department as well as the Indonesian embassy and even calling into the barracks where he was being held. He ultimately was released, only to, as you can hear, return and continue to be an eyewitness to the struggle of people fighting for human rights. And I thought I would end on this point, and not to emphasize him over all the people in East Timor in Indonesia who risk their lives every day to fight for their freedom, but to say that we play a special role in the United States as U.S. citizens. We have a special responsibility because, as I was describing, being in that hospital the day of the massacre, of how people view us. They view us as two things, and it's also very important being here at Caltech, which has so many contracts with the Pentagon, to think about this idea. And that is that we represent the shield. We can do something here. Often it just takes a phone call to a congressman, but when the people of Timor try to march in the streets, they're gunned down. The people of Aceh are gathering now, and we know about their bodies turning up in fields wrapped in barbed wire. We do not face the same thing in the United States. We can make a tremendous difference, no matter what our professions, just as people who care, that we have to make a decision about whether we want to be the shield or the sword. The sword being, of course, the U.S. providing weapons to these different regimes in the world. And every moment of every day, we have to think about that. Do we want to be the shield or the sword? Thank you very much.